Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Ethan Hughes. He runs the Possibility Alliance and Stillwater Sanctuary in La Plata, Missouri. This is Ethan's second time sitting down to talk with me for the show, having joined me last year, in 2012, for our conversation I wound up calling Radical Possibilities. I recommend you listen to that episode first, even if you've already heard it, as an introduction to this one. Once you're done there, come back and catch up. Of course, in this virtual world, we'll still be here. As always, there is a link in the show notes to that earlier episode. You'll find it in the very limited resources section for this episode. This time around, at the suggestion of my permaculture colleague and a listener to the show, Josh Evans, we look more to the practical side of things. Though, as you'll hear, how Ethan and his community practice their methods is as much about the internal work as the external, and ensuring we meet ourselves where we are at to make good decisions that we're ready for, rather than jumping in deep with both feet and no way to cushion the landing. We have to make our own decisions in our own time to build a better world. If you enjoy this or any other episode of the show, please help me keep things happening. Find out how at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to the interview with Ethan Hughes. I'll join you again afterwards with some thoughts and quite a few updates. And I'm glad to have you again, Ethan. Your interview with me the last time is one of the ones that I keep receiving continual feedback on as one of the most inspirational pieces that they've encountered, and a lot of the language that you shared with me and the way that you approach your community is something that I've been using in moving some of the ideas of permaculture and sustainability forward away from just the physical systems to people and community building. But last time we spoke a lot about those like philosophical underpinnings and the way that you practice a gift economy within your home site when you touched on, you know, having inherited some wealth and then giving it all away. And then as you were looking to build the Possibility Alliance, asking for assistance from your community in order to make that a reality. And because of that, some of the questions that I've received are about the more on the ground, if you will, practical aspects of what you're doing in building a society without, in building a community. I would like a society without electricity and petrol, or at least a more functional form of that. But at this time, you're building a community that brings that about. And just people are wondering, how are you doing that? Like when you built your home, did you build that using any of these other tools to get it off the ground, or were you electricity and petrol free from the beginning?
We were from the very beginning. It was an Amish homestead, so when we arrived, there was no power coming into the 80 acres, which has now grown to 110 acres. And we just committed to using our creativity and imagination. There are times when we were building our outdoor kitchen and we needed urbanite, which is recycled concrete. And we had a bunch on the land, the previous owners before the Amish had big masses of concrete everywhere. It didn't break with sledgehammers. So the three teachers for the month wanted to get a jackhammer right away. And those are times when we just move slower. I said, give me 24 hours because there are students and they're waiting to build this kitchen and they couldn't break the concrete on the land with the sledgehammer. And I just made two phone calls and our Amish neighbors had a pile about 50 feet high of old concrete from a bridge site that was demoed. And it was perfect. And it was close enough to go over by horse, pile it up and bring it for the outdoor kitchen. So yes, and we move a lot slower. My wife and I, my two kids live in a 280 square foot straw bale. And it took a long time to build. The horses bring in the materials. We get secondhand windows and doors. We got offcuts, red oak tongue and groove offcuts. The only new material on that building was a metal roof so that we could do rain catchment and be off of any kind of rural water. So there are places where we haven't figured it out yet, but that's okay. And we're looking at shingle oak roofs next, which my wife and I saw in the Pyrenees. They were using oak shingles, which was the tannic acid made it useful enough that you could still catch rain off of it. So even where we make a compromise, we make a commitment that the next building be even more closer to local materials.
This is just a technical question for me because I'm looking at re-roofing my house, and I recently interviewed the architect, Bob Tice, and he recommends at this point largely metal roofs because they can later be recycled, or slate roofs. And I was just wondering, did you use a corrugated metal roof or a standing seam?
It was corrugated. And it goes slower, too, because we're using hand tools. So it's all brace and bid, and which also is wonderful because on our work site, you can hear the birds singing. That's another piece of the way we're building is that you're out in the forest with crosscut saws and felling a tree. It's very reasonable for our psyche as we build.
As you were felling trees, were you then also cutting them to timber with hand saws and axes?
Yeah. So, well, we used some round wood for the roof of that small straw bale. So the white oak, we use the entire tree to hold up the roof. And in other settings, we'll get a salvage barn wood. So dimensional wood inside of that straw bale is all secondhand material from demoed buildings. What we're moving towards is our head builder, who is a BP oil engineer, who's now a straw bale builder. He has been taking timber framing classes. So we've built two straw bales now. Our third one is going to be 100% timber framed, removing all needs for screws and bolts and single story straw bale. So each time we build, we're learning how to remove more and more material. Our straw bale, our second one was built, the first one was earth bags. But to remove any extra material, even the plastic in the earth bag, we built the second one on Osage orange. It's a post and beam, and Osage is in our forest, and it's one of the hardest woods in North America. It can last 80 to 100 years in the ground. So we built it on Osage beams of different widths. So in 80 years, when they start to rot, the thinnest ones can be dug out and replaced without the need of bulldozers or anything else. So we're actually building long-term. Also, for people in 80 years, they can keep the building going with natural materials.
So they can kind of do a find and replace repair of the building, that the larger dimensional structural pieces that are still there can be kept and to do an incremental improvement.
And that's where the creativity and imagination comes in, is we have to think in those long-term periods of time. In most cultures, natural building, you replaster every year. You're used to a building being a living thing that you're adding to. In the Western mind, you build it once and that's it. That wasn't the case with the English cobs or other structures, but now the Western mind is you just put it up and it's done. And so we have to rethink, without embedded concrete and other things, how to keep a living building functioning. Another thing that's interesting in the way we build is that idea, the third ethic, that kind of got buried by later on in permaculture, is limitations create abundance. That because we only have hand tools, we can only go out into the forest and cut so many trees in a day. We can only build so fast that we're building, you know, my wife and two children live in 280 square feet. That limitation is a wonderful thing because it checks us with how much we can impact the natural world around us. I've worked in a sustainable forest with a chainsaw, and you can fell hundreds of trees in a day. With the handsaw, you're limited, and it slows you down again to that creative thinking process. So I think it's really important to realize that by having no petrol and electricity, we slow down, which gives us the time to creatively think. And we don't have any building goals, like this is going to be done at this time. We just go out and give full effort. When it's done, it's done. And I find we create time scarcity. Every permaculture site I've ever been to deals with this incredible time scarcity because they're bidding the wrong timeline. And we create time scarcity by creating deadlines. And so here, by not creating deadlines, we're never behind schedule. And there's always this kind of ease. So I think combined with just the practical nuts and bolts people are curious about, there's also an ethos that allows us to build that way without ever feeling that time scarcity that we create in modern culture.
I'm just thinking about the way that changes the way that you live and interact with the world, that it's not a matter of, well, we have to be here at this moment at this time to get this done, then 15 minutes later we have to leave so that we can get here to do this, and just that mad rush that having access to all this energy and high-speed travel and all these other things, and the way that it changes the way that we live relative to like that hunter-gatherer idea of the sun comes up, I'm awake, the sun goes down, I go to bed, and how living a life closer to those cycles, the pressure that it removes, the stress that it removes. The several times that I've spoken with you both on the air and in setting up interviews and things, you and everyone who I've spoken to in the community, you just sound relaxed.
Yeah. It's a different flow. I just know we work a lot in the summertime. We're working like all other mammals in North America. We are busy. Not busy in the sense of crazy. Like today we're canning all the apples we picked and string beans, and we're just like squirrels are putting up nuts. But there's a rhythm, like you said, the sunrise, sunset. In the wintertime, the sun goes down at 4. We're also like mammals. We're just inside. We don't have electric lights, so we're limited that we can't go crazy all year long. And so these cycles are built so that a mammal rests in the winter, and we rest really well for many months in the winter and recharge. So the more we get connected with the rhythm, the more we feel a kind of in our bones feeling of peace and connectedness in our bioregion. One challenge, and it's important to put out these challenges too, is that we're interfacing with the modern world that's working on a time period. So when we're asked to speak at a university, this year we had a gift economy straw bale class with two amazing builders leading it for 10 days. So we had a few things we needed to have prepared for that class. So in those times, we have an equation. Whatever you think, the most conservative estimate of how long it will do to finish something. So someone gives, okay, we'll definitely be done by this day. We double it and then split it in half and add that half. And so we're always done early. So whenever there is a timeline, because people are coming, we always double. That's our equation. Times it by 2, half that number and add that other half. And so normally we're like, wow, we're done 8 days ahead of time. And again, you create time abundance by just, it's all arbitrary. You just set up a schedule that's really reasonable. So when we interface with the modern world, we create equations that, again, create that abundance. We're not recreating a society we want to move away from, which is we have no time, so then we choose time-saving devices, and those time-saving devices are creating, what is it right now, between 100 and 300 species are extinct a day? That's definitely too many for me.
I think about all the distractions that are built into the modern lifestyle between, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm looking at a cell phone that just buzzed a few minutes ago while I'm talking to you, and it's, well, what's that message? And all these other things that I interact with on in a day that are just regular to me, but how much time that eats up and how my 16 hours of wakefulness, I lose an hour here because of these distractions and things that I respond to that aren't necessary. And the impact that that has on making me feel like I don't have enough time to do something, and then the push to always do something more because, oh man, I've got to get a paper written for Friday, and then, oh wait, well, we've got an appointment on Thursday, so because of that, that means that there's going to be 2 or 3 hours lost. Then there's, man.
Yeah. I think what happens, too, when we slow down, we're traveling by bicycle. There's no community car on site. If we had a car, I know when I lived, I've been car-free for 12 years, but when I was in a car, if something looked halfway interesting, oh, we're 12 miles from a university town. If it looked halfway interesting, I'd go to it, and I'd be like, often disappointed. When you're biking 24 miles round trip, we really select what's most important to us. And so it's another way that we've put these cultural boundaries, as most indigenous cultures have, that actually protect our time for what's most important. Because it's really hard to do when you just have the ability to access. It's the age of information, and there's so much of it. I may have mentioned it before, and we're more interested in the age of transformation. But this idea to act on one principle of permaculture, one ethic fully, that's better than reading 10,000 books on permaculture or approaches to gardening. So, yeah, those limitations, both entertainment, social, everything. We have an amazing social media here, the face-to-face book, where we demand face-to-face human contact, eyes, face, connection. And so then our life becomes more and more rich because we're not participating in things that are can create communication, but at a lesser, it's of lesser worth talking to someone on a screen rather than face to face. And we need those systems because we're tempted constantly to start moving fast and be able to listen and hear and go to everything. And then we're participating with the violence of society is just trying to do everything.
I think about that, and all these distractions and temptations and things are pieces that we bring on ourselves. This idea to do more, to learn more, to know more. And that push is just, now you have me contemplative and meditative for a moment as I think about this.
I can share another interesting thing, like when we do our permaculture class, I've sat in classes where you just, it's information full, it says it, information and imagination dense. We're trying to remove the information. We send students out to just observe leaf structures and, you know, it's 2 hours of them just being in nature observing. And some students are like, hey, I want content. Tell me what to mix in the compost. And we also do that. But this observe and interact is our first principle. And we're so busy getting information, we miss that. Bill Mollison created it by observing and interacting at a slow pace. We actually walked and watched the land for a year before building anything. Most permaculture operations I know do not move to land and wait a year. Because it feels like we got to get it in. We got to get it going. Yeah, again, it's slowing down because if nature is our teacher, we really need to slow down to listen to it. It's rhythms and everything else. And the onslaught of information to me is totally counter to the wisdom, the deep wisdom that I get from just being in the cycles of the sun, being and knowing my, when I go to the bathroom, my waste is being composted. So I really think the permaculture movement, it's so exciting, all this new information and workshops and new ways to do prairie, and it's wonderful. And also, I would use the word psychotic. It takes us away from those rhythms, which the essence of permaculture is about.
That sense of place, both physically and temporally, as we move through the seasons, if we live in a temperate climate, or if we're, how did a friend of mine describe Texas as having 2 summers? And so quickly, our conversation moves from those practical on the ground pieces, those techniques, back to the principles and strategies that we use for building the space around us.
Yeah, I'm excited too. If you want to, I know some listeners had specific nuts and bolts questions, to just go through some of those and I can just give concrete answers and then maybe see where it moves from there.
One of the pieces that you said earlier was about how with like a straw bale house that you're plastering every year and adding to it. What kind of plasters did you use in building your straw bales there?
Interior plaster of our small straw bale is a mix of sand, clay, and cattail fluff. The finished plaster with cattail fluff, it's the seed head, adds a strength, but you can get a really smooth, solid finish. We're finding the more natural plasters here with the clay that we dig up from the land. At first, we did experimental plasters in the outdoor kitchen with lime and a few other industrial inputs that usually make it harder, but it tends, our plasters work a lot better without that, with just the clay from the land, sand, and it would be, the first layer would be fine straw, and then the final would be with the cattail fluff. And some of our plasters, like the outdoor kitchen, will last years and years without having to be replastered. Just know there are some adobe and other buildings studying global alternative natural building where people will replaster yearly if there's places with like monsoon rains and things. But here, we can go for years without having to replaster with a natural mix with no added lime, just local sand, clay, and chopped fine straw, and then cattail fluff.
And you're just finding that it holds up fairly well?
Yeah, better. We really do a lot of experimenting. So each wall was a different mix. We put in horse manure in one, and there are small walls in the outdoor kitchen with adobe brick that we made here. So we just tested them, and some of them, after 2 years, sloughed off, and we had great information. So if you're using vernacular mixes, better to test an outdoor kitchen on a wall that's 8 feet by 4 feet and get the results before you go building a house and plastering the entire house with the mix. What we're just learning now, one of our builders who worked a lot in Tasmania, is this fermented plaster mix. it ferments for not just overnight, but for 10 days, and then the microorganisms actually create an incredibly strong plaster. So we're just getting into these fermented plaster mixes, which have been developed in France and Tasmania. So that's really exciting. The one exciting thing is, because we're going for it and perfectly, we attract a lot of people who are curious, who are, quote, experts in their field. And so they come in and add all this wonderful wisdom to our experimentation.
And then you get to mix all that information with the experiments that you're learning and add to that in a body knowledgeable way, because you're there doing the work, not just reading and thinking about it, but actually on the ground, participating in.
And I have to say, people who come for the apprenticeship, it's an embodiment. Even all the practical things of how we go about things also generate a new way of being. So one of our apprentices already left by bicycle after the apprenticeship was done. Many go and say, I just realized I don't need electricity. Before I came, canned music, this huge list, and at the end of 7 months, they're like, wow, life is so much richer without it. You can't just write that down and believe it. And that's one place where I have a lot of empathy for folks who don't have access to a full embodied experience of returning to a natural cycle. It takes months for people to go through this kind of detox and then find a new way that's actually tested experientially more meaningful. It's not an idea. They leave and they just know, like, I'm going to be biking and not using electricity. And it's just an embodied thing. There's no moral statement about it. It's just we enjoy it more. But then you have an incredible revolution. And then there's nuts and bolts around it where we have to find compromises. We have 1,500 visitors. If we go too far in certain directions, visitors won't even be able to land here and be comfortable. So I know you had mentioned earlier about what are you using your composting toilet. We have options. We have a basket full of mullein leaves and lamb's quarters. Not lamb's quarters, sorry, lamb's ear, that people can use as natural toilet paper. And that's in a basket. And we also have an option of bulk purchased 100% post-consumer toilet paper that we buy bulk, so it's not in plastic wrapping. We get a big box. So we have both. And a lot of our systems here also embrace that we have college groups and fifth graders. And so that way people have a choice. Those who want to get a little more experimental can reach for the mullein. And we have a little write-up about it. And other people can go for the 100% post-consumer waste toilet paper. That would make a huge impact. If everyone in the United States used 100% post-consumer waste toilet paper without plastic wrapping, that would be a wonderful leap. And then the next leap would be have a big area of comfrey and mullein. And then you've really dropped it to very local. And it probably helps with the composting.
In buying the 100% post-consumer bulk toilet paper, how do you... I feel so strange asking this question because I remember a time when there was no internet to look these things up.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I used a phone and a telephone book to find information. And I would call around, and now I almost feel mystified by the idea of being able to find a product in bulk that you would need without access to these information sources. So how do you access where to get some of these supplies?
We're near a university town, which was part of our design to be near a university town, so liberal arts college, university, and then a founding school of osteopathic medicine. By having that, we're rural, but being next to that, there's a buying club where families buy bulk and function as a co-op. So where we do need to bring some of those things in, we go through the buying club, which is both economically cheaper than a natural food store, and also you can get numbers high enough where you can avoid packaging. So that's wonderful. That's for us transition. As we're just harvesting our own wheat, all by horse and by scythe, and we're making all our bread from the land. The first time this year, we now have our dairy cow, so the butter and the milk. Each system we bring in, we then cut off one of these systems, which is still moving in the right direction, bulk organic, as bioregional as possible. So that's the pace that we have here, too, is, okay, we're not going to bring in a new animal. We have bees, chickens, ducks, goats, cows, draft horses. And we started with just one. We started with chickens. And once we had that system well, black walnuts falling from the trees that we feed them in the wintertime, free-ranging, so they get insects. Once we have a good basic permaculture system starting up, then we get the next animal. Then we got the goats, and we had the goats functioning and found out, oh, they love cattails, and feeding them hundreds and hundreds of cattails, and we eat the cattail hearts. And when we strip them, that goes to the goats. And then finding all these systems localized to feed them, honey locust pods fall, and we can collect 20 bushels in the morning, and the goats love them over winter. So we bring an animal in slowly. People come here and they're like, where are the pigs? Where are the all these other things? We're like, you know what? We're now getting our cattle system worked out. And that's the same with our food production. We have 4 organic gardens, no-till, that are on contour raised bed, and we're just planning to put in a 5th. We've added about a garden every other year, and then we now have a large field where we're producing grain, field crops, 2 areas like that. And that it's a slow movement. We don't come in and say we have to be 100% self-sufficient right now, because then we're back into psychotic behavior. We can't transition out of the industrial world overnight. So each of these systems, we build and get to know it. And once it feels like embodied and we got it, then we bring in the next system. So for some people coming here on our 7th year, they feel like it's too slow. And then I say, well, a redwood takes 2,000 years to grow. Is that too slow?
You're building an incremental design that functions within your time horizon, which happens to be longer than what others might necessarily consider.
Yeah. And even when we do a building, sourcing throwaway windows or secondhand doors as locally as possible takes a lot longer. And it's also very rewarding. I think one thing that's interesting about the internet is it removes all relationships. You just go and get your information, where we don't have it here. I call a neighbor and say, hey, do you know where there's some local alfalfa for our goats within 10 miles? Or I call Don Jack, who's 87 and has barns full of salvage windows. And I say, hey, yeah, we're looking for this type of window. And the very act of looking bioregionally, I'm building relationships, human relationships, with all of our neighbors. And relationship-rich life with both nature and humans is incredible. And because we're going by the phone or biking down the road to our Amish neighbors, when we're sourcing things, we're building relationships. And I think that's one thing people haven't seen that the internet has taken away. You're not interacting with anyone directly often. You're doing a search. So on people's deathbeds, their regrets is no relationships, not following their dreams, not living out their heart. So it's interesting that we're going against our very human nature to be in relationship and be in community, favoring something that maybe is quicker. And I know in my marriage, I would rather have the depth of 12 years and a slow walk in the woods. You can't replace that with anything. Speed is overrated.
The more and more that I walk down my path, the more and more that I agree with that sentiment.
But I think when our lives are overwhelmed, you know, Sarah and I, it's been a 20-year process of me removing and simplifying, you know, nuts and bolts. Like, you know what? I downhill ski. I just studied that it messes up black bear migration in Vermont. I'm going to walk up the mountains from now on. That was 20 years ago, and it led to each time I could embody and then make it part of my human culture and then take on something new. But when we're in time scarcity, when I go back to visit my friends in Boston, they're so overwhelmed that they can't even imagine removing any of these things, because their life, you know, one quote from a friend was, I'll be torn apart. Like, I won't even be able to function on my basic responsibilities. And then we get into the whole culture of debt. You buy a house, you owe the bank, there's interest. Everything's built to speed you up, and then you have to be a consumer. And it starts this very predictable feedback loop, which I don't see people and judge them. I see them and I'm like, wow, this is really sad. I give all my money away and I have more capital than all my friends on the East Coast, who they're like, wow, how do you manage a family? You have, you know, at any time the possibility line says $1,000 is a lot in our account, which would equal 2 months of paying for 15 adults, 2 children, and hundreds of visitors. But most of my friends are actually in, if I do the math, they're in like negative $200,000. So it's an incredible paradox. By living in the gift economy and giving everything away, I have more physical assets in abundance than people who are working and making $100,000 a year. It's mind-blowing. And my brother pointed out, because he doesn't have any debt and lives in an apartment, he's 45 and has a roommate, and his friends are like, why don't you get a house and invest? And they often harass my brother saying, well, your brother's irresponsible. And he'll turn and say, my brother has no debt. How about you? And so it's really, I mean, it's capitalism. Once you go down this rabbit hole, it's fine to think about moving slower and using a handsaw instead of a chainsaw. But then we also have to go to the macro and start questioning everything. And that's where it gets exciting and scary. That the very permaculture ethics and values and principles, they're brilliant. They force us to question everything. Zero waste, very favor biological resources, true earth and people care. And so the hard thing is, if we really become bioregionalists and permaculturists, our lives will be drastically different. And I think that's the jump we need to give resources for people. We need to give them the resources to make that jump.
One important thing, though, that I think you pointed out in weaving together that narrative, though, is that it's not about doing it all at once. It's not tomorrow I'm going to decide that I'm going to call the power company and have them turn off the electricity and start using my wood stove, and you spent 20 years getting there. Your interns come and they spend 7 months embodying this lifestyle in order to kind of realize the possibility of biking and living without electricity. And then when they leave, they're in a place where they can make that decision.
And I think, you know, Sarah and I didn't have a system like this set up, so it took a little longer. I was a lone wolf for a while, swimming upstream and mainly getting a lot of attack energy, even though I was just doing it for myself. So it's great to have these pockets of support. I think embodiment happens faster when we get the support and resources we need. And I also realize sometimes you come up against a wall, and I believe there are tens of thousands of people at this wall right now in North America, based on our only 7,000 visitors who've come through in 6 years, but enough conversations to realize I think there are people ready to leap. So there's a balance between taking a risk, having it be scary, and pushing forward and not going into overwhelm so all your systems shut down. But I do feel like there could be a little more risk-taking. I say that with a lot of love and compassion, but there's a way in which we can keep waiting for the next year. I love what Gandhi said is, every day take one, even a tiny act, to move towards the world you want to see. And that might be, I'm not going to use a pen anymore, I'm going to use pencil. Some reduction in impact. And I think that as long as we're moving forward in whatever small act, I really applaud it. And I also see a lot of people thinking their way out of that risk.
Could you elaborate on that? That idea of thinking their way out of that risk?
Yeah, it's only from my own direct experience and also watching people around me. When I was planning to give away my money and get out of cars and really simplify, my story was that my life was going to fall apart. Yes, it was important for the earth, but literally my relationships would fall apart. I would be a dependent. I would feel often fearful. I had all these stories of what would happen. And all of them were completely wrong. I started to bike all the time. I got in better shape. I'm 42 now, and I'm in incredible shape. I don't need a gym membership because I'm always moving by bicycle. I slow down. And I don't know if I mentioned this last interview, but when I visit people, I have to bike up the hill in Berkeley, and I spend the night with my friend. And when I had a car, I would just drive by for lunch for 2 hours. So my relationships are all enhanced. My physical health is all enhanced. Having given away everything multiple times, I have no fear now. How great to have no covetedness on an object. Someone's like, can I take your bike? I'm like, great. I had a bike stolen because I wasn't using a lock. The next day, 3 bikes arrived, and I gave 2 away. Actually, the results were so different than my mental story. And it's not that it wasn't heartbreaking at times or difficult, but life has challenges no matter what you're doing. People get sick. We die. Things break down. That happens no matter what. But there's a deeper peace and meaning when my bike breaks down or whatever else might happen. But what I find is everyone who takes that leap, the story, the mental story they told was often totally wrong. And I found that, I find that in myself. I just committed to look at no more screens. Now, I only spend about 4 hours on a screen a year, simply because I visit friends and they're like, oh, look at this YouTube, or look at this thing I made, or I made a commitment when I stopped watching movies. My brother studied movies to watch one movie a year. But I realized, even 4 hours, I want to be interacting with real life, people and nature. That's it. And so these commitments, at part, they're scary. I'm like, what is my brother going to think? But then I realized that my brother's love for each other does not depend on a movie. We can be creative and find something to do. One thing we came up with is I mountain bike and I tie a rope on a post and I tow him on his rollerblades, which he enjoys much more than going to a movie with me. But we're forced to be really creative and really imaginative when we have to replace these things. When we get creative, we become alive. For my anniversary the other day, nuts and bolts thing, we don't go to restaurants, my wife and I. We chose to push that money in different places. But for my anniversary, I had a friend dress up as a waiter. I had a friend play accordion. And we set up the dinner table on the dock out over our pond, covering cattails and ducks. And they set it up like a restaurant. And Sarah didn't know. And we walked down the path. And I said, let's just go for a walk before dinner. We show up, and there's my friend, and we made a menu. It was a dockside cafe, and there's Sarah and I stepping out. We had two people take our kids. We're sitting out on this dock with tables, cloth, and flowers from the garden, and someone's playing accordion, and then they served us dinner. And Sarah's like, this was 100 times better than any restaurant on the planet. And she was surprised. We got the same delight as if you'd take your partner out to a restaurant. It took more creativity, depending on more human relationships. But in the end, the result was way greater than what an industrial society could offer. And that's when I think we're doing true cultural and natural design, permaculture. We did it on our terms and made the experience even better than a restaurant.
And everyone you included in that process added more to those human relationships because of the people that you included who were close to your life, rather than some anonymous musician or anonymous waiter, that these were your friends who were part of this with you.
Yeah, and that uplifts my wife as a surprise. It's like, these people care about me.
What you're doing, Ethan, is simply amazing to me. I mean, for me, there's an idea that Mark Lakeman shared with me when I was speaking with him, and it was this thought of, whose story do you inhabit? Am I really living my own life within the story that I want to create, or am I living within someone else's?
Mm-hmm.
Hearing the successes that you've had and the places that you've been able to go, though I might sit here sometimes when you're talking through this, I was told once that human beings are really good at piling on. And some of that, those negative thoughts about, oh, well, I could be doing more. And then I think about what you said before the first time we spoke about meeting someone where they're at and realizing, well, that this is where I'm at. And taking a few minutes to realize that, wait, let's think about where I myself was a year ago, or 2 years ago, or even 3 years ago, and all the changes that I've made in that time to get closer to living the life that I want to. I might not be where I want to be yet, but I am still on that journey. I'm taking steps forward.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Comparison will kill us. People come here, it's very imperfect in the extent that people can still point out, oh, you're using a bike rider. And we know that, and we're comfortable with that. But at least they say, I can see where I'm heading now, or I can see the map. I hope there's a million experiments and they all look different than the possibility lines. Nature is diversity. That's another teaching. So we help to support projects that are going to be distinctly different. And I do think we need celebration, that wherever you're at, you make that movement to a simple movement. A professor from Grinnell came down with their students for a weekend and he got very overwhelmed being here. Then he went home. And they have a movie on Sunday night. They left Sunday morning. And he just decided, he's like, hey, can I tell you a story about where I was just at? And his son cuddled up next to him, and he told a story for an hour about his experience here. And it was so connecting. And then he called me and said, it was so amazing. On Monday, he's like, I told a story because I'm so afraid that video games and movies will beat me. So I don't even want to take them on. That my son will be like, shut up, Dad, I want to go watch the movie or play the video game. And the son stood there, totally engaged, and he called and said, I did it. last night. I was like, yes, that is what it's about. Just like a simple step in the moment, and to celebrate that fully. And if we're both doing that for each other and as community, celebrating the act, not an ego kind of you're awesome, but just celebrating like you move closer to the world you want to see. That requires celebrating. What you said about the story is so true. The Hopi said, those who tell the story rule the world. It's all stories. And everywhere we turn, we see a story that for revolution, you need the internet. You need to consume to be happy. That's the story being told, even in alternative. You need fair trade chocolate or you'll be miserable. We need new stories to define the human culture and the earth. And so storytelling is so important. Celebration and storytelling in this current time, I think, are essential. I want to thank you, too. I have the experience that your Dominic Barter just came here to do a workshop on restorative circles, which we're now studying an alternative to the punitive justice system. We've committed to not bringing in the police. And we had someone show up this year that was escorted out of the county by police, another county, and showed up in our woods. And we put it to the test. He was here for a week. We got him back on his feet. And now he's doing activism with the Keystone Pipeline. What Dominic Barter said is, to be changed, you have to feel the other person. And I think that's such a beautiful thing, is to let us feel. If we feel the earth and what's happening and we feel other people, the change will be effortless. I'm just reading what led to Martin Luther King standing up against the war and really changing from civil rights to global justice, as he read an article about children dying in Vietnam from Rampart Magazine. He was in his office and he saw pictures of the dead children in Vietnam, and he let himself feel it. He stood up in the moment. He said, I'm done. I'm taking on the war machine. And it's because he felt the world. And I think also we're conditioned to not feel. The news goes so fast. And I think slowing down to feel, and then once we feel, action becomes effortless. It's like non-action. I guess I'm getting to the point that I really feel like when we're in conversation, you feel and are impacted by our experiment. I think if we all did that more, the actions would arise by themselves.
I find it funny that you say that, because as I was sitting here kind of speechless, taking all of this in before you started down this next thread, was that you and I have spoken between this conversation and the last interview and some of the others. We've spent maybe 3 to 4 hours in conversation. I feel like I know you and what you're doing and who you are as a person better than some people who I've known for a decade or more.
Mm-hmm.
Straddling this edge between the life that I've lived in the modern world and always being pushed to go to college, get a job, buy a house, have a family, like all these normal milestones that were presented as the way to live a normal life. And this other side of going down the path to live the life that I've always wanted to live and feeling kind of conflicted between the two as I make that transition, just because of the fear of the success of living my own life in a certain way. Thinking about all the people who I've known for so long who I've never really been able to connect with because of the stories that they've inhabited and the way that they've lived someone else's life rather than their own.
Mm-hmm.
I feel happy for the people who live the lives that they want to, but I feel a little sad then for the people who are almost trapped by those stories.
I find when I'm with my family and old friends, I really have to function by just listening. Just me showing up starts triggering people. I come to the family picnic and there's paper plates, and someone comes over and says, oh, we're sorry, but they're left over in the basement. And then one of the aunts is like, I don't want you to come see my redo of my house. I'll be embarrassed. And it starts going. Paper plates go in the trash. Oh, I'm so sorry about this. Everyone's apologizing to me. And I'm just enjoying being with family. And of course, I'm choosing to bring my own plate and cup, and I don't say anything. But really, all I can do is just listen to their pain and their confusion, and then I stay connected with them. And I think that's such a gift we can all give as we're pushing forward towards ecological social justice or taking risks. It's hard sometimes to not have a shared reality, but I find most of my time I just need to listen to what comes up in people and really honor it and trust that for some people they're never going to be able to hear my full message. But the first thing to stay connected is to allow my grandmother to have a meltdown because I'm not driving, that she's never going to see me again, and that I'm ruining the family, and to really just hear and say, oh, I hear this, and did you hear I'm committing to being with you more this year than last year? And I think that's important work, too, is to those who are stuck need a lot of love and compassion. I don't think information is useful or challenging is useful. People are on a deep level, I think, get it in their heart. They just can't imagine getting out of $300,000 of debt or whatever they've gone down. And, yeah. So it's interesting. I think we need to be very ferocious and risk-taking in our own lives and balanced so we don't go into overwhelm. And we need to be incredibly compassionate and kind and gentle with other people's lives. And, you know, modern activism is like, we'll ram this down your throat and then we'll have the world we want. And there's a small category where people really want to be challenged. And so when people come here, we'll give the tour, show them what's happening. And if they ask me, like, what do you see in my life? How should I change? I stop and say, well, what do you want to change? And if someone really wants to be challenged, I'm like, do you really want to be challenged on this idea? If they say yes, I check again. If they say yes, then I'll share my limited perspective. But I think I'd love to see a greater gentleness. And I think people actually make more radical changes in a pillow of kindness than they do in a pillow of fire or judgment.
I only have a glimpse of some of the places that you've gone to in order to get where you are, but I'm very thankful that you've arrived at this moment and have shared it with me, and just thank you for that.
I mean, one thing that's important, I want to share just a few shadows to balance this interview, if that's okay right now.
Sure.
One is, I've gone through incredible heartbreak, and I do believe, Rumi, that the door of devastation is the door of love. Is so many pieces of myself have had to die. And the path of becoming who you want to come, birth is a messy thing. There's a lot of pushing and blood, and the heartbreak is part of our breaking open our heart for the world. But there is a lot of grief and sorrow as much as joy and beauty that informs this experiment. So that's the first thing, that it's not that you're just going to choose to do something and then Muppets come out of the trees and start singing, and you take that radical leap and then your life changes and relationships changes, and it can be really heartbreaking. The woman who biked out of here, she's 23. She's like, I'm biking home and I'm doing electricity free. Her mom drove across the country from Virginia to intercept her on the way to Chicago. And her mom had her sister say, you know, don't let your sister into the house if she bikes there. These are the kind of heartbreaks, like, oh my gosh, I'm finally doing what my heart wants. Now my family says I'm ruining the family. And these are the kind of struggles where we need a lot of resources and compassion. It led to an incredible breakthrough between the mom and the daughter. And when we live our truths, it usually ends up in a breakthrough after the blood and the pain, like a birth. On the other side is this baby, and you're like, oh, I'd go through this 1,000 times. But when you don't see the baby, it seems like your family's falling apart. It's really hard to stay the course and keep coming back. And also one of the shadows here is there are times when we don't figure out a bioregional solution. We have a 100-year-old farmhouse. It was concrete, cinder block. The clay was pushing it in. We have some of the greatest horizontal clay heave next to New York State. So the house is falling in. So we're like, okay, how do we do this? Everyone said you need a bulldozer, you need all this stuff. But we finally settled with getting recycled I-beams, and we needed an acetylene torch, which we borrowed from a friend, to cut the recycled I-beams to prop up the basement, and we had to get some recycled rebar and some new concrete. It was a lot better than a bulldozer and huge anchors, and it worked. And we worked with a friend who had done basements. But there are times when we don't find a local solution, like either the house falls down or we use recycled I-beams and we get an acetylene torch. I believe there are 15 times when we've had to bring in some really clear industrial input on the land because we couldn't find another solution. And that's okay. We're like, okay, we're not going to build a house in clay with a concrete floor, so we can build differently next time. But there's a way in which I think that we've really, collectively as a community, we don't beat ourselves up. And I think if we give it time to find a third solution, if we don't, we keep telling people when they come, we're like, look, here are all the places we haven't figured it out. Help us. I think that's another important piece with the fact that, you know, we have a phone line, a landline. Most people say it's very primitive. It's our only technology, like any kind of energy coming in on the land. And people are like, what about the phone? We're like, yeah, power lines, we don't know how to figure it out, but we want fifth grade groups and colleges to come. We haven't figured this one out. They think it's really hard to even talk on landline. Some groups won't work with us because we don't have email. But, you know, we don't have a solution. And to just sit with that and be like, but we're going to keep looking at it. And what I think is each one of our lives needs literally hundreds of people to help us problem solve. Like what you're doing right now, your journey in bringing this information to the world and looking for changes in your family, you need hundreds of relationships to help you problem solve each little thing. Because if you try to figure out yourself, which I did in the past, I become really overwhelmed, isolated. Then the judgment starts coming up. So I think it's a time of building relationships and circles and just to realize that we make a lot of compromises here. And we just don't jump to the industrial right away. You know, we didn't have a wheelbarrow when we showed up. We borrowed our neighbor's real wheelbarrow for 9 months and we looked for a secondhand wheelbarrow all over the county. We went to auctions and couldn't find one. So after 9 months, we were like, we can't borrow our neighbor's wheelbarrow. We're a permaculture site. We don't have a wheelbarrow. And we didn't have the infrastructure to build a wooden wheelbarrow yet or the time. So we went and purchased a new wheelbarrow and we found one that was built at least in Mexico and not in China that still required what I would call inappropriate labor in some form of sweatshop on the Mexican border. But we tried. 9 months was a good go. And we got a wheelbarrow and returned our neighbor's wheelbarrow, oiled up and repainted. And so there are lots of times when we have to make those decisions and we try to make it the best decision we can.
As has seemed to be the case the last several times that I've spoken with recent guests who have mature perspectives on the world that they want to see and the life that they want to live, I don't have anything else to add at the moment. Can I ask a few quick questions and we'll bring this to a close?
Yeah.
You touched on your gardens being no-till and you're adding them every several years, or adding one like every other year. About how many square feet of garden space do you add each time and how much do you have at the moment?
Probably in our vegetable gardens all combined, maybe 3/4 acre, and then maybe with the field crops and everything else, maybe that would be an additional 1/2 acre. And then a lot of perennial food sources. We've added over 1,200 perennial food sources, fruit, nuts, bushes. So we're really heavy on perennials. So we are growing everything from medlars to Manchurian apricots to cold hardy kiwis. In addition to the garden and crop space, we have edibles planted everywhere. I mean, we've added just 50 mulberry trees, and we have 11 mature mulberry trees. We've added 25 service berry plants. A lot of them local wild food that we enhance. We find blackberries growing in one area, and then we move tons of the same species of wild blackberry there. On top of that, we eat hundreds of pounds of wild edibles. So we just got a chicken in the woods mushroom, 20 pounds of mushrooms. We eat hundreds and hundreds of cattail hearts and feed the rest to our goats. We get maybe on a good year 30 to 40 gallons of autumn olives that are wild, non-native wild. So it's important to realize we're just not functioning on the garden. We have dairy from the goats, from the cows. We have aquaculture. We eat 100 fish from our pond, and we've just restocked 3 new ponds as we added 30 acres. So it's a very diverse food system. 90 pounds of honey on a good year coming in from the bees. Cicada, the year of the cicada, we fried up and ate many cicadas. We'll find a fresh roadkill, coyote or deer, and eat it. We get deer. We canned 7 deer 1 year from like trophy deers where they take the antlers and don't want to eat it because it's a buck. So we have multiple systems happening. We glean fruit trees within 10 square miles that are mature. So I hope that gives an insight to the diversity of food.
It does. One thing you mentioned about roadkill, at least here in Pennsylvania, if you pick up roadkill, you're supposed to report it, especially if it's a game animal. Do you have any requirements like that where you live?
You do with deer. We didn't call in on the coyote because there's like an open season on coyote all year round.
Okay.
So there's certain conditions. And also, just for listeners, we're very clear, we processed a lot of meat. We know that it's a fresh kill. You know, really, after 24 hours in the warmth, you don't want to be eating an animal. So you have to really know how to see the signs that it's a very fresh animal. Yes, we try to use a lot of wisdom when we're eating wild edibles and in roadkill and such.
That also makes me think of the other legal issues. You mentioned living without police intervention and trying to have an alternative justice system. Do you have certain legal things in place for the Possibility Alliance and the land that you work on, things like liability insurance? If fifth graders or a college class are coming in, do you have any waivers that they sign or anything like that?
We don't, and that's a stance that we're taking. I went and lived in New Zealand. I was there for 4 months, and they didn't have a legal system. I was on a sailboat, and I climbed up and looked down at the skipper who was going to bird sanctuaries, and I was volunteering crew on it. And I was going to jump off the mast, and I looked down and said, oh, and he said, you're not in the United States anymore. If you fall on your head, you can't sue me. Only the government can choose a case that's so extreme that there'd be compensation. And the freedom people have, this was in New Zealand in 96, and I imagine it's changed quite a bit. But we want to create a culture where, again, you're building on relationships again. And we do not want to move in the legalistic area where it's fear-based. And we've also had situations where a friend fell from a staircase in the barn, which is only 8 feet tall. She happened to fall in the right place where she cracked her head, broke her back, and was in intensive care for 3.5 weeks and almost died. A helicopter came and life-flighted her off the land. And so we, you know, from some interactions, the parents said this amount would have been covered by homeowners. And so we rallied as a community and said, here's this amount. And we said, we will also raise whatever other amount you might need. Like, instead of this relationship where I'm going to sue you if you don't help me, that in any condition, let's create a world where if someone, not even on my property, down the road, gets into an accident, I'm going to support them. And we have handed checks of $1,000 for a Mennonite who didn't have health insurance so she could get Lovenox because she was had a blood clot and she had a baby in utero. And I want a world like that. Little La Plata, 1,200. Like, the Midwest is ahead of the East and West Coast. We had a family here who the dad had a stroke in the 40s. They had 2 kids in high school, and the insurance didn't cover it. And we had a fundraiser at night, and in one night raised $44,000 with, you know, low middle class people in a town to pay their bills. That's the world I want to see. We're all coming together, and people are crying and celebrating and just saying, we are part of your family. And instead of giving $400 to some profit-driven insurance company, what if everyone in a town of 1,200 gave $400 a month to a fund for whoever needed it in that town? How much more empowering and how much more money there'd be for that person? So we're, you know, we're taking a risk because we're going upstream, but we're looking at a total reworking of how we deal in human relationships. And sometimes it's scary, but we're willing to lose this 110 acres, willing to lose everything to try to create something that aligns with our heart.
That's real freedom. I just think about that for so many of us who are seeking the ability to live our lives and to be free, that it's that lack of fear really provides an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I mean, Gandhi said you had to develop fearlessness to practice upliftment of all life, and we have to deal with it every day and move through it.
I don't have a nice, smooth segue to my next piece from that. But I only have one more question, and that's about children.
Yeah.
Do you homeschool your children on site?
We're dealing with that design creatively right now. We've been blessed that a lot of friends from the East and West Coast have come out here and seen beautiful land at $1,500 an acre with oak and hickory forests and ponds. And they're like, well, I could buy in Oregon for $300,000 or get 10 acres for $15,000. So we've had a lot of families move around us. And we've started a cooperative. On Fridays, we have things like adventure days where the kids all come together and I dress up as Dr. Fibian and we go looking at frogs in the pond. And other things like that. And we just this fall are starting a cooperative school, and it'll probably start with just around 10 kids, but it's a beginning, and we want to move into a kind of outdoor, pulling from the Norwegian outdoor schools, some Waldorf, some nonviolence, and basically we're starting up a school in the area. We're putting out applications for teachers. With that said, we're looking at 20 hours a week, because most of the kids, like my daughter Etta, who's 6, and my daughter Isla's, who's 15 months, this morning at the morning meeting, they were at the grapevines picking grapes together for a half hour. Etta yesterday went out, 2 days ago, went out on the horses. She woke up and was like, what am I going to do today? Phoenix was taking the horses out with the wagon, and any 6-year-old girl, it's a dream come true. She's on the wagon working the horses. So we find that school is so rich here that homeschooling isn't like just a nuclear family model. We have 15 adults on site and over 1,500 visitors from all over the world. So she's exposed to so much. She's fluent in French at age 6 already, and we just let her kind of naturally choose when she's ready to take something on, combined with the wonderful socialization that happens in a school. So we're building this co-op, aiming at 20 hours a week in a kind of school setting. The rest of the time, all these families are in homesteads where it's very rich. And the kids also, there's a Wednesday play group where they go to the lake and can just have free play together, and that's 10 to 20 kids. So we have a creative way of raising our kids both collectively. Most of the families are within walking distance, so my daughter can go play with my friend's daughter, Ella. They're the same age. And they have Etta for the day, and then the next day I'll have Ella and Etta. And so it creates incredible abundance, too, as parents. We have a lot of open time. And Sarah's mom moved down the road, and dad. So we have grandparents. My mom's moving here part-time. One of our other members' parents are moving here from Chicago. So we're really building a multi-generational movement where everyone can enter. Sarah's parents, they're in the Plata. They have wood heat, but they have electricity. They have an organic garden and 12 orchard trees, and they have rain catchment, but they also have internet and a hot shower. So they're moving at their pace, which is wonderful. And everyone's kind of moving towards this goal at all different locations. We can all hang out and enjoy the entry points. And so for our kids, we have one big thing is family of all generations and friends where we're sharing the care of our kids and school settings where we're doing explicit learning. Like I was Baroque Bob and we went out all day into the forest and identified trees and very hands-on learning. So that's kind of where we're at right now. And I think in a few years we'll move to actually offering an amazing alternative school for everyone in the area.
Another wonderful, inspiring conversation, Mr. Hughes. Thank you so much for this time and answering the questions, but also bringing in all the different elements of what makes the work you're doing functional. I really appreciate that and understanding the mindset and the perspective that goes with it. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to this conversation for the listeners?
Yeah, just one, I feel really honored that people had a lot of questions and were interested in our last interview. I would like to just say that what's moving in your heart is real, that sometimes people we connect with are very isolated in a city or somewhere else and feel really misunderstood. But this yearning to actually have social and ecological justice, this yearning to have a world with no war, it's an authentic urging. As Martin Luther King says, the universe bends towards justice. Whatever your worldview, love, God, spirit, the wonderful aspects of creation, just to say, like, it's a real yearning. It's authentic. It's not crazy. And if I can quote a superhero, the Tick said, you're not going crazy. You're going sane in an insane world. And so, yeah, I'm just honored to be here and want to offer, too, that people can come here and visit and get a taste of it and start getting, as I call them, possibility cheerleaders. Find people, the few people in your life who are cheering you on to live an authentic life. And yeah, it'd be wonderful to, through this medium, to make real human connections down the road, which I'm sure will happen. So yeah, I'm just excited and hope maybe one of the listeners I'll meet face to face at some point, and that'd be a great gift.
I would kind of like to do a permaculture road trip and make stopping to visit with you one of those points.
Yeah, great. And just thanks again for, it's always wonderful. I do have the experience, too, of sitting down with an old friend under a tree when I talk with you. So thanks for the heart that you bring into this process.
And thank you for this time. There's an idea within storytelling from the Greek traditions of Chronos as the passage of time, but Kairos are those moments of meaning, that those memories that you have, those things that stick with you, the birth of a child, or times like this, that first conversation that we had, and the things that I remember from it and carry with me, and now to have another one with you. So thank you for this Kairos in my own life.
You're welcome. Have a wonderful day. It's been a really wonderful start to my morning.
And that was Ethan Hughes. Much of what Ethan and his community do rest in their embodiment of what they want to accomplish, in their lifestyle. As a result of that, there's not much you're going to find in the resources section of the show notes for this episode. What you will find, however, is Ethan's contact information. You can send Ethan in particular, or the Stillwater Sanctuary in general, a letter by addressing it to either of those and sending it to 28408 Frontier Lane, La Plata, L-A space P-L-A-T-A, Missouri. The zip code is 63549, and they are located in the United States. Or if you'd like, you can call them, 660-332-4094. You can also visit them at that address, but make sure you send a letter or call ahead and arrange the visit before you go. Though they're open to visitors, please consider their community and personal space, as well as your own. I can easily say that my first interview with Ethan was one of the top three, if not the number one, interview episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. I think that this follow-up will wind up ranking right up there with it. What I loved about this conversation, as well as the last one, was Ethan's candor and honesty with us about how their site and lifestyle is an ongoing development, as well as telling us about their successes and failures, and being completely open about this being a gradual process. We have to move at our own pace and in our own time. Some of us will be able to do that quicker than others. You know, of course, others will be slower. But as long as we keep putting one foot in front of the other, we can get there. Something else about that personal timeline that stood out among the many other quotable moments from this conversation was that idea that speed is overrated. I can completely understand that, especially after the life I've had this fall. Watching the weather change, now as ice begins to form in the stream behind my house in the stillness of the water as it flows around rocks, as the cardinals and blue jays begin to rest upon the bird feeders, and just things slow down. I'm kind of thankful for that shift, if only ever so slightly so, in pace. It reminds me that I'd rather do one thing at a time really well than to do a bunch of things all at once that aren't my best. To provide and create a level of quality to what I do rather than quantity. To do that, I think, requires us to slow down, but also not to look at a task as so daunting that we live in fear of it and never start, or that in order to do something it requires perfection, finding our own personal level of comfort. I know I've mentioned before that I have tattoos, and in one of the shows, I think it was the interview with Damian McEnany when we were talking about professional permaculture, being able to shave my beard and put on a long sleeve shirt to cover my tattoos to go into a meeting. And one of the series of tattoos that I have are on the back of one of my arms, and I have three yellow nautical stars. And I got those done as a reminder for myself of when I was in elementary school, and my teacher would put a gold star on a chart to track when I'd had a really good day, and that good day was me doing my best. But also understanding that my best wasn't always the same every day. And now I have that permanent reminder that I carry with myself, that I can do my best. But each of the stars are slightly different sizes, so sometimes what is my best is a little bit more or a little bit less than the others as I continue to work forward. And I struggled with that idea of doing my best because I felt that it had to be perfect every time, and if it wasn't perfect, it wasn't good enough, as well as my own fear of success or being a failure. Those I carried with me for a long time. Once I started exploring my own road and started doing different things to really begin to try my hand at living authentically to myself, to think of my conversation with Bill Wilson from some time ago, and at living the life that I wanted to, the failures weren't as big as I told myself. The setbacks, though often and sometimes pretty big, really weren't as horrible as they could have been. So now, every day, I can accept that, yes, things are going to happen. Sometimes they're going to be bad things. Sometimes it may be a day or 2 days or 3 days or maybe even a week before I make progress on what I do. But I take a step, however small, closer to the life that I want to live, and in telling my own story, rather than listening to the story that someone else tells me about how I should live, or trying to inhabit their stories and expectations of me. It isn't easy. I'll never say that it is, but we can walk this road together. Where are you going? What do you want to do? What do you want to accomplish? I'd love to hear from you and help you in whatever way I can. As always, you can call me, 717-827-6266. That's a Google Voice virtual number, so rings me wherever I am. If I can, I'll answer. Usually the best time is Monday through Friday between about 9:30 in the morning and 4 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern time. But if I don't answer, I will get back to you. So go ahead and leave a message. Let me know who you are, what you want to talk about, and your number. If you're in a hurry and want me to get in touch with you within a day or two, calling me is the best way to make that happen. Otherwise, if you can take some time, send me an email. show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. As I say, that is the slower method, as things come in just often enough that some things get buried, or I'll read your message and think, you know, I want to spend some time on that when I can really sit down and consider it, which may take me a little while to get back to you. But I will get back to you. I can guarantee that. I just can't guarantee when that will be. And of course, in this age of social media and the interconnected online world that some of us participate in, there's also Facebook and Twitter, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or I am @permaculturecst. Looking ahead, the rest of the year is plotted out for episodes, as you'll hear in a moment. But more importantly, thanks to your feedback and some of the direction that that's given to me, as well as the professional advice that I've had, and just my friends being critical and honest with me about what I'm doing, 2014 is looking to be an amazing year already. To get everything in place, I'm delaying some things in order to move others ahead. The first of those that I'm moving forward with is a new server to host the podcast and online PDCs, as well as my professional permaculture site for consulting and such. The specs on the new system are much quicker than what I've got currently, so you should see responsiveness increase if you go to the website. Also, the time that it takes to download episodes should be shorter because I have a lot more bandwidth and a bigger pipe to take care of that. Or if you're one of the students participating in a PDC, if you haven't heard the latest update that I posted to the classroom, the transition for this should also make the classroom site run a lot quicker. I have a good friend of mine who knows much more about servers and server migrations than I do, handling this move for me. It should be mostly seamless, but when I know the move is imminent, I'll make an announcement on Facebook and Twitter or in the introduction to an episode if there's enough time between when he tells me we're doing this and it happens. All of that is planned to occur before the end of this year, 2013. As I put together this episode, I already have the new host under contract. My friend's done a complete backup of everything that currently exists out there and is planning to do some of the migration over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend here in the United States, which will be Saturday, November 30th and December 1st. I'm just waiting to hear from him on what everything is that he'll be doing. Once that new site is rolled out, I have a web developer as well as a graphic designer, two people, in place to provide a new look and feel for the website, and also make sure that access to the information occurs in a cohesive way. Several of you have asked for a master index of episodes, both in chronological order, so that you can peruse the shows from the beginning through to the end, rather than seeing them listed as they are on RSS feeders or on the current blog, from the latest to the oldest, as well as an index by topic. That's part of the process of creating this new website and something that I'm putting together for that. So expect that shortly thereafter, the website move. And I'll let you know once I hear from the developer and the designer on how to make that happen. I've also made the investment in better software so that I can continue to create high quality content in a reasonable amount of time, which I'm happy that the new host for the website can easily handle. I've also got the workstation needed to allow for even more growth, especially in the video realm, specced out with the parts ready and available to be shipped to me so that I can do the build. Now I'm just looking for the right time to place that order, either coming up in December or January, so that I can begin that project and spend the 3 days or more that it's going to take to make that transition. In order to get all that set up, I'm delaying the next PDC Plus for a few months so that I can get the bugs worked out for the new site and create a better registration and tuition payment process and system. Also, because I'm asking some of my current students to stay on with me as teaching assistants for the upcoming classes, I want to make sure that everything for that is lined up and I know who will be taking on those responsibilities with me, and also to coordinate the guest instructors and material that I'd like to have for future courses. For those of you who have been following the conversation about a membership program to support the show, that's also going to be delayed for some time. So if you're in a place and you'd like to make a small donation in the meantime to help me before that program is put in place, please do. That will make sure that all of this that's going on can happen much quicker. In the meantime, regarding this membership program, I continue to work with folks in the permaculture community to include more great benefits for you once the program's in place. I'm looking to do this and do it right, which means it'll probably be 3 or 4 months at the end of the first quarter or beginning of the second of 2014 before this membership program comes online. So I'm looking to prorate that program for 2014 for anyone who's interested. Otherwise, the options for that, now that I've met with my accountant and run all the numbers, is that I'm looking to include a 1-year membership, a 3-year membership, and a limited number of lifetime slots for those of you who are interested, with the cost being $50 for a 1-year membership and some kind of discount for the others. But that covers my updates regarding the show. Now then, on to what's coming up in future episodes. Next week on December 3rd, Jack Spierko of the Survival Podcast is with me. I know many of you have been looking forward to that episode, so I can say here it is. And his work was what inspired me to create the Permaculture Podcast. So it was a fun time to talk to him and hear his perspective directly. I really like the way that he delivers his ideas and asks pointed questions to get people to think. After that, on December 10th, is the second part of my conversation with Mark Lakeman, where we cover more on urban permaculture. And I also think Mark's first interview with me about building delight in public spaces, I think really ties in well with both of the conversations that I've had with Ethan Hughes. So please check that out before you listen to the second one with Mark Lakeman. The last new interview for the year is going to be on December 17th, when I talk to Adam Campbell, who is a member of the community at the Possibility Alliance and the Stillwater Sanctuary, with Ethan and everyone else. Adam and I wound up speaking for about 4 hours the day that I called him to talk. So I'm going to be breaking up that conversation into different pieces to release over the coming months. So that first episode near the end of December is just an introduction to all the places Adam and I wandered. To round out the year, I'm working with Peter McCoy for him to create a short piece to hopefully be released on December 20th to introduce us to him and his project, Radical Mycology, which I'll then follow up with an interview in the new year. The week of Christmas, there will be no new episodes, as I'll be spending time with my family and friends. The last episode, though, for the year will be on Tuesday, December 31st, and is a look back over 2013 and the time we've spent together, the many interviews and episodes released. I'm planning for that to have kind of a primer feel for the show as a whole, both to remind those of you who've been with me for a while of some of those episodes that were from earlier in the year, as well as some of the best from 2012, and generally set us up to be ready for an incredible year in 2014. If you have a friend who you want to introduce to permaculture, that last episode of the year is probably going to be the best place to start. I've also started recording interviews to ring in 2014. The first of those will be released on Tuesday, January 7th, and is my conversation with Arthur Haynes, where he and I touch on the idea of wild foods, which he introduced to us in his first interview when we talked about foraging. And that's going to wrap up this episode. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other, and that little bit of legal. The Permaculture Podcast is released under Creative Commons, Attribution, No Derivatives, Non-Commercial License. Feel free to share it with whoever you want. Just tell them where you got it from, and don't change or sell it.